Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you probably wonder, am I live or not? Last Friday, I kept saying, well, I'm live, but I wasn't, because we unexpectedly had a dropout of our equipment. I was out of town. I still am out of town. I was in Oregon Friday instead of in my home studio in California. And our equipment did not hook up properly. I was unable to get it to work. So at the last minute, I asked my producer to play a recorded show from the past. And so we played one almost at random. And it happened to be the show that my first broadcast after I got back from Israel. And I was letting people know, you know, this is not a recorded program. I'm back. This is live. And yet it wasn't true. I wasn't live. Now, obviously, that has made some of you probably wonder, well, he says it's live, but is it live? Well, if it is in your world, Monday, July 3rd, 2006, and you're listening around 2 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time, then this is live. So check your watches, check your calendars. If you're looking forward to tomorrow being the 4th of July, then this is today's program you're listening to. It is live. And that means, of course, that as is usually the case, you can participate in the program. You can call. You can ask a question about the Bible or Christian doctrine or behavior or any of those kinds of things, Christianity in general. You can raise an objection either to the doctrines of the host or simply to Christianity and the Bible in general if you have such objections. This is one place where you can feel free to bring them up, and you will not be threatening anybody, at least won't threaten me. And I'll turn around, I won't threaten you either. We can just actually have a rational discussion, which is what should be possible at all times if you have doubts and concerns about whether Christianity is true. So just give me a call. And the only thing that's not working today is my call screening software. But that's a small problem. What it means is that normally I'm able to look on an internet screen and see if there are calls waiting or not and who they are, so that I'm, like when I'm talking to a caller, I know if there's other callers waiting because I can look at my screen and see that. But today I don't have that working. That program's not functioning here. So there will be only a slight delay if you call up. My call screener will tell me in my headphones that you're there, and then we'll know you're there. So let me give you a phone number if you'd like to call. As far as I know, our lines are open. Is that true, David? Oh, we have, okay, we got Tom from Monterey first, but if you'd like to call during the program, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090, and so we'll go directly to the phones and talk to Tom calling us from Monterey, California. Hi, Tom, welcome to the Narrow Path. I've got to give him some volume there or something. What's happened is my call screener is taking another call at the same time he's trying to manage things. We need to hear from Tom. Maybe the calls are just pouring in. I don't know. And the call screener is distracted. Well, I know that Tom is going to be our first caller today, and I'll wait for my control room to manage to link him up here to me. I am in Idaho at the moment. I had to come up here for some business and was not able to get back in time to do the program from home. I should be home tomorrow, Lord willing. But Dave, we need to talk to Tom. Can we put Tom through? Are we having any technical problems there? Well, while we're waiting, let me take a question that somebody has written in. And this is probably a question that a lot of people would wonder about, or maybe they don't even know that they should wonder about it. And that is, the writer says, is asking Jesus into your heart scriptural? Now, I say that a lot of people may not have questions about that, because it's just a taken for granted kind of thing that when you're evangelizing people, you advise them to ask Jesus to come into their heart. But is that really scriptural? I'm not aware of anything in the Bible that uses that kind of language. I think the statement, often is sort of a spin-off of a passage in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 20 where Jesus said, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and eat with him, and he will eat with me." So we have a picture of Jesus standing at a door knocking. Presumably, somebody has to open that door, and what door would Jesus be at but the sinner's heart? And so I think that's where the idea of asking Jesus into your heart comes from, the idea that Jesus is knocking at the door of the heart. The Bible doesn't anywhere ever talk about inviting Jesus into your heart. Paul does talk about Christ dwelling in your hearts by faith, so the idea of Jesus being in my heart is not an unscriptural concept, if we understand what it means. The problem is that I would never tell an unbeliever to ask Jesus into his heart for the simple reason that the apostles in their preaching and in their writings never told anyone to do that, and I'm not sure that the idea would carry important information to the person. I mean, what do they picture? That there's a little Jesus knocking on the door of their heart, and, you know, when you say yes, that the door opens and he walks in and he sits down somewhere in a couch in your heart. And that, I mean, that might be something that works well for children, and I believe that probably a lot of people have been evangelized with that kind of a line and have really truly gotten saved. But a lot of people probably haven't, because the idea could be misleading. It almost makes it sound like Jesus is simply just wanting admission in, but not making any demands. And this is the problem, because people need to understand that what God calls people to do is to repent of their former lifestyle and make a total surrender of their life to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. When they do that, then they pass from death unto life. God gives his Spirit, and the Spirit comes to dwell inside of their hearts. But it's not that a person gets saved by saying, "God, put your Spirit," or "put Jesus in my heart," or "Jesus, come into my heart." But rather, a person gets saved by having this transition of their life take place where they have renounced their life of sin and have now confessed Christ as their Lord, as the one that they are now going to follow. That's what salvation entails. If you will confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved, it says in Romans chapter 10. But to confess that Jesus is Lord has to be sincere, of course, because not everyone who just uses that word is really saved. Jesus said, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven." You can use that word without it meaning anything to you. Jesus said in Luke 6:46, "So why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do the things that I say?" So obviously, having Jesus as your Lord means that you are recognizing that your obligation is to do what he says, that you've made a surrender of your own life and your own will to his will for your life, and you're determined to walk according to his will. Once that decision has been made, once that commitment is genuine, I believe that you do become a Christian and Jesus comes to live inside. But a lot of people, excuse me, who have been told, I've got allergies here, I don't have them at home, but I have them up here in Idaho. A lot of people have been told to ask Jesus into their heart, I think, don't have any conception at all that he's coming in to take over, and that you're allowing him to come in by like a surrender of an invader who's saying, "Okay, lay down your arms, lay down everything, and hand it over to me." That's what it means to have Jesus come into your life in a saving way. And this idea of just open the door and let Jesus come in, like having a guest come into your home, is certainly a different concept. So the Bible doesn't ever talk about asking Jesus to come into your heart. There would be probably nothing heretical or overly surprising about some passage of Scripture saying something like that, but we would certainly have to know what the terms were and what that involves. But it isn't a biblical term, and if Christians use it at all, they should realize they're not using a biblical phrase, and that they may not be communicating to the person they're talking to exactly what kind of demands Christianity makes of them. All right, Dave, do we have Tom available to go on? Okay, so we do have our lines full, and our engineer is trying to get them connected online with us. I'm not sure what the problem is, but once in a while there's a switch that's not thrown right or something, and it takes them a while to see what's gone wrong. Anyway, we will continue to anticipate our conversations with these callers, and you need to know that once we've talked to a caller and they've gone, that you can call in at 1-800-438-5090. I do have an announcement that is important for especially our Portland area listeners. Last February, we began broadcasting in the Portland area. We've been broadcasting in other areas for about 8 years or more. But it was a new station added, KPDQ 800 AM. And it just so happens it's the most densely populated area that we have, that we're buying radio time in. And it was the most expensive, it is the most expensive station that we're paying for. But all that is well and good. The main thing is that in order for us to stay on that station, it's going to be necessary for us to receive regularly some support for radio costs from our Portland area audience. And I want to say we have been able to pay up to this point, even though we don't have a lot of support coming from the Portland area yet, because our listeners in other areas have been so generous that we've been able to pay for the radio stations the other people are listening to, or even internet listeners have been sending donations. And obviously it doesn't cost us much to go on the internet, but what they have sent in has been applied to keeping us on in Portland. But I only mention this now because last month, June, was the first month that the first of the month came and we did not have enough in contributions to pay for the Portland station. We pay in advance. We're not in debt, but we pay in advance for the time, and we pay a month ahead of time. And normally, you know, if I don't have enough money to pay a station, I'm going to have to give them 30 days notice and we'll go off the air there. But we were so close to the amount needed that I was able to find some money from another fund, actually my own money, and put it in. But it was not an awful lot. It didn't cost me much. But it cost me something, and I'm just saying that if that came up another month, we might not be able to continue there. So our Portland area listeners, I just want you to be aware, because some of you may really like the program. A lot of people probably don't, but if you're one of those people who really likes the program, would like to see it stay on KPDQ AM, it's going to be fairly urgent that listeners in that area do something to help us stay on. And, of course, no matter where you're listening to us, we pay for the radio time, whatever station we're on, and we do have a very, we got a steep budget. I just checked it out. I've been giving a different figure over the air, sometimes when I've mentioned before. Right now I think we're paying about $8,000 a month to radio stations to stay on and to the phone company. So that money just, we don't have any sponsors and we don't have any commercials. We don't sell anything. And usually I don't say very much about it on the air, but from time to time, I think it's in the interest of our audience that they know whether we're close to the mark or falling short of the mark, and whether our broadcast in their area might be endangered. And so I'm saying this for the benefit of those who listen to the Portland broadcast. We do need to get some support from that area if we're going to be able to stay long term on the station there. And okay, we're going to try it again. We got Tom there. Hello, Tom.
Hey, that worked that time.
Hooray! Good to hear from you, bro.
Hey, nice to hear from you too. Hey, well, you know, we've been calling about Catholic things for years and years and years, and just about covered all the issues. And anytime somebody calls in about something Catholic, it sparks my attention, and so then I have to call on the phone. So when you get that email from the nun about the praying to the saints and
yes,
having images of statues and whatnot, that I figured, well, I think I'll call in, and I know you've got other calls on there, so it won't take too long. But
that's all right.
I just wanted to bring up that to me as a Catholic, and I think it's just basic common sense, our humanness, we have Hall of Fames for baseball and football, and we've got the Stock Car Hall of Fame. We got all these people that we revere for being excellent at what they do, and I don't see, as a matter of fact, I kind of see Jesus pointing us to these people to get closer to him.
To inspire us.
And just like Mary, which I know you say is not our mother, but Catholics believe she is all the mother of the Christians. She is probably she's the first Christian, and she is probably the closest to Christ that anyone will ever be, at least here on earth. And because the people who have died and gone to heaven are closer than we'll ever get on earth to Christ, we feel that we can ask for their prayers, ask for their advice, that type of thing, and I don't find a problem with that, because like we talked about before, was it on Mount Tabor where the Jesus talks with or converses with Moses and Elijah. Obviously those people, at least one of them, is dead, and Jesus was conversing with them, so there must be some kind of reason for that. So I think
okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Now everything you just said, of course, is related to the idea of prayer to the saints, or asking the saints to pray for you, or something like that. I think the issue that we had addressed, that the nun was writing about, was the issue of images more.
Right.
Use of images. And I know to the Catholic that's a similar thing, because the images are images of the saints, and these are the same people that you feel that you can, you know, talk to and ask them to pray for you and so forth. So it's a related thing, but in my mind it is a different thing. And you and I have talked before about the issue of prayer toward the saints, but I don't know if we've ever talked about the images before. And what was going on there was that she was saying that, you know, to have an image of one of the saints, of St. Francis of Assisi or Teresa of Avila or someone, or Mary.
Or even Jesus, I would say.
Or of Jesus. She said that's not really that much different than having a photograph of your children in your wallet, you know. And I was saying, well, to me it differs in a number of ways. For one thing, if I have a picture of my children in my wallet, I'm not venerating my children. I love my children, and I have affection for them, and the picture reminds me of them, especially if I'm away from home. But I don't look to them as somebody that I
well let me ask you
that I don't bow down and kiss the pictures. Let's put it that way.
Sure, and I agree with you, and I will. I think any true Catholic will tell you that there is worship of things like that, that they're not supposed to be worshiping. They're supposed to be honoring those people, not worshiping. Only God deserves worship. But I think that if you had a picture of Chuck Smith in your wallet to remind you of where you came from and how you were guided by him as your scriptural father, and he guided you, and you looked at him and you said, "Oh, thank you. Now I remember back what you told me years ago, Chuck," and you're not bowing to him, but you are showing him honor and reverence, that he's a very knowledgeable man, and he guided you. And at that point, I would think that you would probably be a little bit closer to Christ just through him. Maybe even seeing his picture brings you back to some knowledge of Christianity. So,
well, let me say something about that I agree with you about, and that is that the Bible does tell us to remember. For example, James tells us to remember the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering, affliction, and patience. And also, James tells us to remember Job. And I certainly, in my own mind, and as a Protestant, I have no problem at all giving a list of people in the past history whom I admire and who inspire me. Some of them from ancient church history and some from modern church history. There's no question that the memory of certain people's heroism helps to inspire heroism, and that's a good thing. It's a little different, though. Let's say you mentioned if I had a picture of Chuck Smith in my wallet. Well, I probably wouldn't carry a picture of Chuck Smith in my wallet, but if I did have one, and the only way that would in any way have any impact on my spirituality would be if, by looking at that picture, I remembered Chuck and all that he in real life really was to me and the kind of person he was, and that inspired me. But see, even if I didn't have a picture, if I just had his name written on a piece of paper and it reminded me of him, it would have the same effect on me. What would be strange to me would be if I was able to look at a picture of Chuck and start talking to him and think that he can hear me. And I started, you know, kissing his feet and made a statue of him to put in my house. This would move over a line, and it may be a hard line to define, but where the Bible says not to make images and not to bow down and worship them and so forth, I think it's saying something a little different than to say don't remember people or don't be inspired by people. I think when you make an image of them, when you venerate the image, when you feel like you're closer to that person when you see the image, or you act toward the image as if that is that person. And I'm not sure all Catholics do that, but some Catholics do. I mean, we certainly know that there are images of St. Peter whose toes have been worn down to nothing by people kissing them. And those people weren't Protestants, generally speaking. But there's a difference. There's a difference between the Catholics' veneration of these images from that of an ordinary person just having a memory of somebody that inspired them. And where one crosses the line from one attitude to the next, I don't know. But I just consider that making images is certainly not a necessary way to remember somebody. You can remember people without that. And what's more, if I have a photograph of either Chuck Smith or my kids in my wallet, it really looks like them. You know, I mean, it really looks like Chuck, or it really looks like my kids. It's a true likeness. Whereas, obviously, images of Mary or of Jesus or of ancient saints, nobody has any clue what they really look like. So looking at the image doesn't tell me anything about, you know, what they really look like. It's not really a true likeness. And I would begin to think of that person, whom I've never seen in real life, in terms of the way that image looks. And that image, in a sense, would almost replace them in my consciousness. But, I mean, I'm not saying there wouldn't be some sense in which that image could inspire me insofar as it reminded me of their great virtues. But I don't need an image to do that. And it seems awfully treacherous to bring images into a church and to have people act toward those images with the kind of veneration that some people do, when there is a clear command of Scripture not to make such images and not to worship them. I realize the Catholic can say, well, I'm not worshiping them. But is that really possible to make sure that we haven't crossed that line when we actually have images and we're looking toward them, praying toward them, whatever? I mean, I personally just think it's unnecessary. Why do it?
Mm-hmm. And
it's risky.
And I would agree with you to some extent, but I think that, again, being human beings, and because God revealed himself as a human and as a male human being, we were given that ability to, at the very least, in our minds, be able to see Jesus as a man. And whenever we think of Jesus, we think of a man walking the streets of Jerusalem. And so when we do see a statue of that, we are reminded once again that this is Jesus. And I think that even a person who sees a picture of Jesus or a statue of Jesus, most of the time, most people would say, there's no plaque on there that says, Jesus, Son of God. People look at it and they say, that's Jesus Christ. And that automatically starts in their brain. They start understanding, okay, well, this is obviously God, or at least it's Jesus Christ in their mind. So, but let me bring up one quick point. You had mentioned very briefly that Aaron, when he made the golden calf, that he made an image of Yahweh. I see that in Exodus 32:8, I think it is. I don't know, maybe 32:4, something like that. Anyway, I think you're taking that out of context, because it, all the way through there it says, let us make gods in the image of the one that took us out of Egypt. And all the way through it, even God himself says to Moses, when he's coming down the hill, I believe it's 32:4, he says, let us make the image. image of the gods. And then in 32:8, God kind of explains it and says, he doesn't say that you made an image of Yahweh. He says you made images of God that brought you out of Egypt. Now, back in Egypt, they had all kinds of different gods. They had the bull god. They had the alligator god. They had all kinds of things. And I think God is saying, it's not the point that you are making. You're worshiping me. You're worshiping other gods. And that's his commandment, not to do that. So.
Well, I read, it says, O Israel, here's what Aaron said. Mm-hmm. It says, he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool, and made a molded calf. And he said, this is your God, probably Elohim in the Hebrew, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And then he says, Aaron, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation, said, tomorrow is a feast to Yahweh.
Right.
So it sounds like he was identifying the idol with Yahweh, but perhaps that isn't the case. Here's the problem.
What does 32:8 say? I don't have it here written.
32:8 says, God says, they have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it. And they've said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So they're basically identifying the calf with the God who brought them out of Egypt, whom they acknowledged to be Yahweh.
But then Moses comes down and he says, you guys are really screwed up here. And he says, anybody who is for, I think it's Yahweh, he says, anyone who's with the Lord, come stand by me at the gate here. And only the tribe of Levi, the sons of Levi, come to him. So obviously those other people, if I'm taking it in context, would not be worshiping Yahweh. They would be worshiping something else. That's
okay.
The way I take it.
Okay, fair enough. I do need to move on to other callers,
right.
But I do want to say this. I want to say this too.
Sure.
You know, I have never been a Roman Catholic, and I've never bowed down before an image. I've never prayed toward an image, so I don't really know what is inside the heart of a person who is doing it, all right? So I can't say, well, the Roman Catholic who tells me that they're not worshiping this image when they bow down or when they pray to the saint, I don't know that they're lying. I mean, maybe they're not worshiping the image. I don't know.
Sure.
All I can say is I believe that it's easy for the heart to be deceived into idolatry and to think that the image really does represent God or does represent the saint or does represent Jesus or whatever. And possibly in one's own heart be giving much more credence to the image than they're even analyzing in their own mind whether they're doing. For example, if having an image of Jesus makes Jesus seem more real to you than not having one, then there must be something about that image that to which the reality is being attributed. And to me, that steps over a line that I would not want to cross over.
Mm-hmm.
That's my position. Okay.
And I respect that, and I would agree with you in certain instances. You're right. So anyway, but I just thought I'd call in since there was a Catholic issue coming up. I just love calling in about that. So
it's always good to have you call in and weigh in on those issues.
And I do need to send a check in. So God bless, and I'll hopefully get that out to you quickly.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Bye bye.
God bless you. Bye bye. Our next call is coming from Jacob in Houston, Texas. Hello, Jacob. Welcome to the Neuropath.
Hi, Steve, brother. Good to hear you, and it's good to have you back from Israel. I hope you had a good trip.
I guess it was a good trip. I enjoyed it. It was rather the travel was hard, but it was fine.
Okay, good. Steve, my question, it's a two-part question on the same topic, and it's a little important because, to me at least, that I am presenting a few of these points to my fellow brothers at the little church I go to, so I'm trying my best to get them together. And the question is as follows. It is on the domain of tithes and offerings. I got some wonderful points off the paper on the Neuropath website, and I added to that two points which I have added to me appear very, very strong, but I'm curious as to why you didn't mention them at all in your paper. One of those points, actually both of them, come from a book by Michael Webb, a very well written book called Beyond Tithes and Offerings. Now, in this
I think I have that book on my shelf. I have not read it.
Oh, it's an outstanding book, Stephen. It compliments your paper very well. But he says, he makes a very, very eloquent argument for the fact about this one fact that money existed from the very, you know, very beginning of the Bible, of recorded Bible history, and never once did God ask for tithes in money. I mean, the formal tithe was never a money item. So that was my first question: why you didn't mention that at all, or have I missed something? Secondly, in Malachi, when God says, you know, is rebuking the people and the priest, saying, listen, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, is it, two or three scholars have mentioned this, I checked it on the web in a couple of places and in Michael Webb's book as well, that the point there is not so much the people, but also the priests. He was addressing the priests because he says earlier on that the priests were bringing blemished offerings. These were, lame animals, etc. Well, God,
they were accepting them. Yeah, they were accepting blemished offerings. Right.
So is that fact that bring the whole tithe, is he talking bring, quote-unquote, whole, W-H-O-L-E, whole tithe? Is that what could have been meant as well?
So well, you mean to say perhaps the priests were not bringing the whole tithe to God, and that they were misappropriating some of it? Is that your suggestion?
No. That Michael Webb's suggestion is that the whole tithe is, don't put the word the in front of whole. Bring whole tithe. Bring unblemished tithe.
I see. Well, okay. The problem with this is, first of all, it is true that the Bible nowhere says that a person has to give money as a tithe. And it was in food. Basically, it was usually grain that was given as a tithe. The Pharisees, of course, extended that to all kinds of things they grew, like garden herbs, mint and anise and cumin and so forth, and Jesus commented on that. I think they're supposed to also give, if I recall, a tenth of their livestock. And in that case, of course, a tenth of their livestock could take, you know, the most blemished livestock and they would be cheating God then. They're supposed to bring the best of everything. Although in the case of grain, I don't really know that there's a quality of grain that is necessarily ordained. I mean, when it comes to sheep, or goats or bulls, obviously they couldn't bring a crippled or a flawed, blemished bull or lamb to God, because that was considered inferior. But I think the vast majority of the tithe that was brought in was in the form of grain. And I don't know if there is such a thing as flawed grain. Maybe if some of their grain had gotten moldy or something like that and they brought that, that'd be an insult. But I don't think that the rebuke about the tithe is directed to the priests, although I acknowledge that the book of Malachi at many points does address the priests directly and the Levites. I mean, it does seem to be, in many respects, a rebuke of them. But the reason I think that it'd be the people as a whole who are being rebuked about the neglect of the tithe in Malachi chapter 3 is because the priests weren't actually required to bring the tithe anywhere. They were the receivers of the tithe, and it was their food. It was their support.
Okay.
And that being so, I don't think that they would have any motivation for neglecting the tithe. It's not like they were the priests were supposed to receive the tithes from the people. All right, let me put it more exactly. The Levites, the whole tribe of Levi, would receive the tithes from the people, and then the Levites would give a tithe of that to the priests.
Exactly. The priests, and so isn't it possible that The Levites were not really bringing, you know, the perfect tithe to the priests?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I guess I don't have enough information about that. I feel, as I read Malachi, that it's the priests more often than the people. and even more often than the Levites that are being rebuked in the book of Malachi. I think he mentions the priests. I don't remember exactly what he says about the Levites, although he does say in chapter 3 that when the Messiah comes, he'll purge the house of Levi, and they'll offer a pure sacrifice and so forth. And so, I mean, it is true. The book is directed primarily against the priests of Israel. But the command to bring the tithe,
okay,
I just don't see it as likely that that's commanding the priests to bring the tithe, because there's, once they received it, there's nowhere they're supposed to bring it to. It was their food. People brought them food, and that's the form it took. Now, I've heard the point made before that you brought up, that the tithe was never commanded in Scripture to be given in money, but only in terms of grain and agricultural produce and so forth. And that is true, but I think that in addition to the fact that there was such a thing as money in those days, that food was also a barter item. It was a form of wealth. And I think the reason they might have brought grain would be because that's a currency that is accepted in all nations. Whereas if they were going to do it in money, they would have to perhaps take money from their own countries and bring it and get it changed into temple currency or whatever. And that caused all kinds of abuse, as we know. And Jesus had to cleanse the temple because the money changers were taking advantage of people's vulnerability in that area. But I think is that it's simply saying our wealth, a tenth of our wealth was to be brought. And although grain is the medium that was normally mentioned, I don't think it was the case that they were forbidden to bring money. And since in our own society, most people don't raise grain, and their increase is in the form of money, I would think that it, in principle, would have been thought to apply across the board.
I'm certainly not applying any of that to a hard and fast rule today. I'm just saying in the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant, God was very particular. At least Michael Webb makes the case that God was very particular in what was acceptable to him. And even though there was money, there was a lot of money in the system, this thing was, God was very, very particular that it be received in these particular mediums. And the money was, of course, a separate item. But, Steve, at least you've certainly given me a little, an idea of where I'm a little clearer on what I want to emphasize now.
Well, your question was, why didn't I include those points in my article on tithing? I think now you know why I didn't include them, but that doesn't mean they're not valid.
Correct.
You might be able to make them validly. It's just the reason I didn't include them in my article on tithing is because I didn't quite think of them as maybe as clearly or as being as significant as what Mr. Webb might think.
Okay. Steve, thank you. I know you've got callers waiting, so I won't take you. I have a pressing question, but I'm going to leave that till tomorrow.
Okay. Okay, that'd be great.
Steve, good to have you back, brother.
Hey, Jacob, before you go. Wait, Jacob, you there still?
Yes, very much.
Okay, my call screen told me that callers have dropped off and we don't have callers waiting. So if you do have a pressing question you want to bring up, you can do it now, and I can give up the phone number. Do you want to bring it up now or tomorrow?
Yeah, I would like to bring it up now then.
Okay, let me just give out the phone number and tell our listeners we have some lines open for you. If you want to call at 1-800-438-5090. Looks like we'll be able to get to your call today. We've got about 15 minutes to go. 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're talking to Jacob from Houston, Texas. Okay, go for it, Jacob.
All right. Thanks to you, Steve. Steve, this question is relates to your very, very outstanding message on the topic of war. I have to confess, it really touched my heart very deeply, more, in fact, than you would ever know. And, we often think of, part of my heart was given over to, to really, I guess, given to violence and killing the bad guys. And I really had to rethink, where I came from on that topic. But one thing, when I have brought up this topic to a couple of other people, they've also been very touched by your message on war. The question that has come up, though, is you do mention that the case against capital punishment cannot be sustained, at least you believe that it could not be sustained in either the Old or New Testament. Could you shed, could you speak about that a little bit? Because I know if I'm allowed to do this in my Sunday school, this case about capital punishment is going to come up.
Sure. Well, when I say that I believe the case against capital punishment can't be sustained in the Old or New Testament, what I mean is that certainly the Old Covenant, the Old Law commands in many places that capital punishment should be brought against criminals of certain who commit certain crimes. The New Testament does not address magistrates in quite the same way that some of the Old Law does. I mean, much of the Old Testament law is directed right to the Hebrew magistrates about, okay, here's somebody who's done this crime, here's what you do to them. The New Testament might incidentally speak of the duties of magistrates, but there's no part of the New Testament that's directed toward the magistrates exactly, because the church didn't hold magistracy in any of the lands that they were in those days, and all the documents are addressed to the church itself. But there are some hints or some ideas of what the early Christians might have thought about capital punishment. And you may have heard me say this before, but I believe that the most clear indication that the early church still believed in capital punishment is found in a statement Paul made, not the one in Romans 13. Most people bring up Romans 13, and that too could be seen as supporting capital punishment, because Paul says that God has ordained the state to punish evildoers, and they do not bear the sword in vain. Obviously, a sword is not an instrument of imprisonment, but of killing. And so that passage could be taken to support capital punishment. But even a more clear passage that, to my mind, is when Paul is on trial, and he appeals to Caesar. And when Festus wanted to do the Jews a favor, it says in verse 9 of Acts 25, Festus wanted to do the Jews a favor and said, Paul, are you willing to go to Jerusalem and be judged before me concerning these things there? That is, let the Jews have custody of him, which he knew they'd kill him. And Paul said, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I've done no wrong, as you very well know. But in verse 11 he says this, for if I am an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. Now, the statement, if I have done anything deserving of death, and he means, of course, deserving of being executed by the Roman courts. Mm-hmm. He says, if I've done anything like that, then I don't object to being executed, is what he's saying. He does not, in principle, object to capital punishment when the party who receives it deserves it. He's simply saying he does not deserve it, and therefore he does object to it in his own case. But he states it that I would have no objection to dying if I had done something worthy of death. In that statement, Paul acknowledges that there are things that a man can do that are worthy of death.
Okay.
And that if a man does them, then Paul, in principle, does not object to that man being put to death by the proper judicial authority. And so it looks to me, now see, Paul could have said this. Paul, if he felt differently, he could have said, well, listen, you guys are talking about putting me to death. I just want you to know God is opposed to putting people to death. You know, God doesn't give anyone the authority to put anyone else to death. So, I mean, if you put me to death, yeah, you have the power to do it, but you'll be violating God because he doesn't believe in putting people to death. Now, Paul didn't say that. Paul said, he says, at least Paul is speaking for himself, and I certainly believe he had the mind of Christ in it.
Sure.
He said, I don't object to being put to death if I've done something worthy of death. But what I do object to is you putting an innocent man to death, and that's what I am, an innocent man. My impression is that he did not object to capital punishment. Now, if someone says, well, then how could you object to, you know, Christians fighting in certain wars and so forth? Well, there have not been very many wars that have been the moral equivalent of capital punishment. Capital punishment, when it's carried out justly, means that only a person who has done something worthy of death actually is executed. You know, I mean, the doctrine of, and the teaching in the Old Testament of capital punishment doesn't say you can just kill everyone who's a trouble to you, but you can only kill people who do things worthy of death, and that's only a certain specified number of crimes that qualified for that. Now, in a war, you almost never will find a war where all the people who are killed in it have done deeds worthy of death. I mean, civilian populations, women and children, non-combatants, have been killed in almost every war. And that makes, in many cases, war more of an atrocity. Right. Now, I mentioned in my lectures on that, that thinkers like Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, somewhat influenced by the earlier thoughts along these lines by Plato, had come up with what they called the just war guidelines. And they were saying, you know, there might be, conceivably, wars that are the moral equivalent of capital punishment, where only combatants, only people who are trying to kill you, get themselves killed, you know. And in my own mind, if there is a war that is that purely delineated, then it would be the moral equivalent of capital punishment. Mm-hmm. But when innocent parties are being killed who have done nothing to deserve it, I don't see that as the same thing as capital punishment. And that's why I would disagree with some people. I mean, I read a book years ago by R.C. Sproul about Christian ethics, and he said, war is just capital punishment on a grand scale. Well, maybe in some extremely rare kinds of wars it might be, but the early Christian writers said it was murder on a grand scale, and not capital punishment. And so I think there would be a very rare situation, and they may exist. A friend of mine just yesterday was telling me that he felt that the American Revolutionary War was a just war on the side of the colonists who were fighting for their liberty, because he said all the people they shot were invaders who were trying to kill them. You know, they didn't go over to England and kill any civilians over there or anything like that. So, I mean, I would have to say, well, you know, he's got a point. I mean, that could be as close to a just war as you'll usually ever find. But I would say war is simply a much more complex moral issue,
right,
than capital punishment is. Now a country that practices capital punishment, their main challenge is to make sure that they don't condemn a man wrongly. People who oppose capital punishment often say, well, how can you approve of it when you know that there's probably been innocent people who've been found guilty in court by a miscarriage of justice, and they've been put to death? How can you? Isn't it better to not have capital punishment to avoid that? And I say, well, that's not a defect in the doctrine of capital punishment. That's a defect in the court system that found an innocent man guilty. That's a different kind of a problem. If a man is guilty of having done something worthy of death, and if he is found to be guilty and the evidence seems to be against him, then if he's to be punished at all, he ought to be punished with a just punishment, which is death. If, you know, on the other hand, if someone says, well, we don't believe in capital punishment because an innocent man might be condemned, I would say, well, it's also an atrocity if an innocent man is condemned to life imprisonment or whatever alternative to capital punishment we want to give. What we need to work for is not the abolition of capital punishment, but the abolition of corrupt courts or courts that find men guilty on too little evidence or something like that.
All right, but Steve, just very quickly then, I'm typically asked on, let's just say there is something like what happened in Rwanda. The Hutus are slaughtering the Tutsis and vice versa. And this is
right.
Outright rape and pillage and the most horrendous atrocities taking place. How can I, as a Christian, grant it? I Jesus Christ has told me not. The Lord indicates that, you know, this war is outside, our sphere and
jurisdiction. Yeah, well, yeah.
But
I understand.
Stand back and do nothing.
Yeah, well, when we hear such atrocities being done in another country, let's say like in Rwanda, where one tribal group is just slaughtering another tribal group, what you have there is a breakdown in justice in their own nation, and it is the responsibility of the governments of that nation to put down that criminal action. Because, I mean, this is, it's like war because it's on a grand scale, but it still is simply an amplification of criminal action that the state is obligated by God to control. Now, the question becomes, okay, what if they have a corrupt government that won't control it?
Sorry,
won't or can't?
Okay.
Okay, well, the next question is, has God given America or some other country nearby Rwanda the authority to go in and usurp the authority of that government that should be doing the just thing but isn't? And I guess there's different Christians would answer that different ways. I would say I wouldn't want to stand by and do nothing But I'd want to do the thing that God wants a Christian to do.
Sure.
And for a Christian to simply, so let's say for an American Christian, to join forces with other non-Rwandans and go in and invade Rwanda, if we did that in order to put down violence or whatever, we'd be violating another country's sovereignty, and we'd have to really have a, I don't know, we'd have to have a mandate to do that, but I'm not sure that we have. And if we say, but we just have to, because look at these horrible atrocities going on. I say, amen, it is a horrible atrocity, and if we could stop them all, I could hardly hold myself back from doing so. But the problem is, there are, frankly, atrocities going on in every country of the world, including our own, including abortion, for example. You know, we've probably aborted more of our own unborn babies than have been killed in all of Rwanda in the past 20 years. I don't know, but the point is, would a Catholic nation like Italy have the right to invade us because we're murdering our babies, you know, and you're doing an evil thing. We can't stand by and just see you do this. We're going to come invade America and we're going to, you know, end abortion by this invasion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You want to intervene. The question is, do you have the right to intervene? Is this a righteous thing that God has given you a mandate? Is this within the sphere that God has given you? And I would have to say, I don't always know the answer to that. Someone would say, well, you know, if we can stop it, aren't we sort of like the priest or the Levite walking down the road and seeing the beat up guy that fell among thieves, and aren't we supposed to do something for them? Well, again, if it's our province to do it, I don't know that we can be the police of the whole world.
Right.
I think that we sometimes try to police those situations where we feel like our own government has a stake in the outcome. But, you know, let's put it this way. The American troops are spread out all over the world and trying to, you know, stop all kinds of things like what's going on in Rwanda. And I'm sure that in many cases we're all well-intentioned. But God simply hasn't given us the ability to stop all the violence in all the countries. And we always say, well, then we should just stop as much as we can. Well, I'd rather say we should stop whatever we're supposed to stop, whatever God has given us the mandate to stop. And it seems to me that the American government, by sending troops to put down atrocities in another country, is kind of missing the mark when they allow atrocities here. As long as abortion's still going on legally, I mean, if the Rwandan government allows atrocities to go on over there, we as Christians can say, I'm incensed at this. I feel like if I could, I'd just go over there and stop it. Yeah, well, I understand those sentiments. I certainly have those sentiments. I also have those sentiments about abortion here, but I don't go shooting abortionists. I mean, there's a sense in which we have to say, what is the mandate that we have in a world that's full of evil, full of victimization? How can we as the body of Christ represent Christ in standing for justice and bringing relief as much as we can to those who are suffering? But it doesn't mean that every kind of intervention we could imagine is really open to us as Christians.
Thank you, brother.
Hey, I appreciate your call, Jacob. Always.
Steve, brother, I'll be calling you or emailing you about the seminar you did on the prophets. I hope you recorded that.
Okay, I did.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll talk to you later. God bless you, bro. All right. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're out of time. We're going to be off here in less than a minute. I need to let you know that if you'd like to help us pay the bills to stay on the radio, the address to write to is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you weren't able to pick that up, you can get it from our website. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Include the word the, or you won't get to our website. Until tomorrow, this is Steve Gregg saying thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow and we'll continue our discussion. God bless.